Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. The Terror of Surviving Cancer by Sulika Jawad. An essay adapted from her book, The Book of Alchemy, A Creative Practice for an Inspired Life. There is a painting of a woman kneeling on the floor, opening a trapdoor, and a light beam is shooting out of it. The Terror of Cancer. The writer Sulika Jawad explores what she found on the other side of her fears. To say I was afraid of mice is to put it mildly. I was terrified not only of how they looked and the way they scuttled along a baseboard, but also of what they portended. This began in 2011, when after months of failing health, I spent a week in a hospital in Paris where I lived. Doctors ran countless tests, but found nothing conclusive. Eventually, they diagnosed me with burnout and sent me home. It wasn't a satisfying explanation. I felt better while in the hospital, but that was because of prednisone, an ordinary steroid. As it wore off, I deteriorated again. For days, I lay in bed, growing weaker and feeling a creeping unease. At the time, I began to hear scurrying in the kitchen. I hadn't cleaned up before my unexpected hospitalization, and I began imagining mice multiplying inside the cabinets. I asked my boyfriend at the time if he heard anything, but he hadn't. I worried I was losing my grip on reality. Several days passed and I was still in bed. My skin was pallid and lesions covered the inside of my mouth. "Something seriously wrong," my boyfriend said. "We need to go to the ER." So I dragged myself to the hospital, where tests revealed that my blood counts had plummeted. The doctor recommended I return home to New York immediately. We went back to the apartment, and I packed my suitcase. Afterward, I climbed into bed, terrified and exhausted, yearning for the oblivion of sleep. Then the noise began again, and my boyfriend heard it too. He hurried into the kitchen and threw open the cupboard. I heard a yelp and felt panic. "Are there mice?" I shouted. "No. Just a bug," he said unconvincingly. Next came a series of crashes and bangs, pots clanging, and a thwacking sound like a broom hitting the floor. I asked again, "Tell me the truth. How many?" He paused. "More than I can count." I suddenly felt invaded, as if my little Parisian studio apartment had been infiltrated by pestilence. I saw the mice as an omen. I flew home the next morning. A few weeks later, I was diagnosed with leukemia, and fear became my dominant emotion. Fear of needles, fear of time slipping by, fear of being a burden, fear that all my dreams would be dashed, fear of grief, not only my own, but also the grief I might cause the people I love, fear of pain, fear of the next biopsy, fear of death. These fears made sense to me. But after I emerged from 4 years of treatment, I found that I was afraid of living, a fear that's much harder to explain. I had lost so many friends to illness, and I had lost that boyfriend to the toll of it. I feared opening myself up to new love. I was afraid of the future, afraid any plans I made would be undone by some errant leukemia cell or other calamity. I'd wake up with the best intentions, but I'd end up back under the covers, so overcome by fear that I couldn't function. And when you're in such a spiral, another fear creeps in, that you'll never experience uncomplicated joy again. After a year of languishing, I managed to shake myself loose when I embarked on a 15,000-mile solo cross-country road trip. It was an extended session of self-styled exposure therapy that began with confronting my fear of driving. I got my license at the ripe old age of 27, loaded up a borrowed Subaru, and set off. Over the next 100 days, I faced one fear after another. I met new people and also grew comfortable being alone. I sat with my grief, and I found I could carry what lingered from lost love to the imprints of illness. I also analyzed my fears in my journal. Sometimes you're so afraid, but don't know why, which makes the fear seem unparsable and intractable. But in writing your fears down, you can evaluate them to see which are valid and which have no grounding in fact. The more clearly I saw my fears, the more I noticed a strange irony. I feared what I wanted most. If you've had your stability ripped away, it can feel dangerous to have hope or to take risks. But my fear was not protecting me from harm, only preventing me from attaining what I wanted, to be independent, to feel strong, to write again, to dream big dreams, to fall in love, to live daringly. Once I knew this, I got to choose. I could brace myself against discomfort, or I could be open to it all. It was like building a muscle, often uncomfortable, sometimes painful, always exhausting. But I became stronger, and I began seeing the rewards. I realized that the more I ran from my fear, the bigger it loomed. Yet if I confronted the fear, it lost its power. As the fear evaporated, other feelings materialized, like wonder and curiosity. And as my friend Elizabeth Gilbert, the writer, once said to me, "You don't have to be particularly brave. You just have to be a tiny bit more interested in something than you are frightened. 1% more curious than afraid." Now to return to the omens. In the years after I finished treatment, my fear of mice persisted. Mice seemed to show up wherever I went. The year before my road trip, I had a mouse in my apartment. I was petrified of it, as was Oscar, my feisty terrier mutt, who had once chased down a bear in Vermont woods. I knew the mouse had made an appearance when I'd find Oscar trembling in a corner. Years later, I moved to an old farmhouse in the Delaware River Valley. And what do you know? Lovely, bucolic hamlets also have mice. Each time I saw one, I called my neighbor Jody to help me get rid of it. I couldn't even look at the mice. That old superstition held sway. And then my greatest fear came to pass. In 2021, I learned that after a decade of remission, the leukemia was back. To relapse after that long is extremely rare, and my prognosis was not good. I thought I might die this time, and that felt frightening. But I had done a lot of work to figure out who I was, what I wanted, and even how I would do things differently if I got sick again. During a second bone marrow transplant, rather than feeling frozen by fear, I invoked a creative practice to defang it. Medication temporarily impaired my vision, so I journaled in voice memos and watercolors. When my husband John and I had to be apart, we stayed connected through the lullabies he composed for me daily. And when I grew so weak that I needed a walker, I bedazzled every inch of its drab frame with colorful rhinestones. Afterward, instead of pity, little Dazzy and I were met with delight and, incredibly, a passing shout of, "Cool walker!" I survived that transplant, but I will never be considered cured. I'll be in treatment indefinitely, and it can feel as if the sword of Damocles is hanging over me. But giving fear free rein makes it hard to live. You're afraid of rebuilding because what you create may collapse, and then you just exist in wreckage. And the truth is, sometimes fear makes it hard to see when things are good. When I returned home months after my transplant, I opened my closet and saw something shadowy and rodent-shaped in the floor. I slammed the door and called Jody, who came over to investigate. Afterward, he came downstairs and said I had a serious problem on my hands. I felt seized with panic and asked if I needed to call an exterminator. "No," he said, "a shrink." It wasn't a mouse. It was a pouch of patchouli. I began working on my fear of mice in clinician-directed exposure therapy, and it worked. I no longer see mice as harbingers of doom. I understand that they're a fact of life in the city or the country. And while I would still prefer to have Jody, whom I call Angel Man for all the miraculous ways he comes to my aid, remove the occasional mouse, I don't feel I need to move out every time I see one. If mice were to return, I could deal with it. That's what I found on the other side of fear, the knowledge that I can handle it, whatever it is, as long as I'm 1% more curious than afraid. Fair Play by Louise Hegarty. The book cover has the title of the book in large red letters, with a picture of a three-story mansion in the middle, throwing a long shadow. The reviewer is Sarah Lyle. A group of friends convenes for an overnight murder mystery party in an Irish country house on New Year's Eve, and each guest is assigned a part by the hostess, Abigail. Her brother, Benjamin, who's celebrating his 33rd birthday, plays the murderer. As in any locked room mystery, for that is what Louise Hegarty's terrific debut novel at first seems to be, real death comes unbidden to the house. The next morning, Benjamin is found dead in his room, an empty bottle of pills by his bed, the door secured from the inside, an apparent suicide, though Abigail insists he wasn't suicidal. The whodunit is afoot. Surely it's a case for the brilliant consulting detective, Auguste Bell, a pastiche of countless famous fictional investigators. From a droll dramatis persona, we learn that Bell was previously seen in the international bestsellers The Guilty Vicarage and The Fountain Pen Mystery, and that he will solve this case in fewer than 30 chapters. It's around this point that the novel begins to reveal its unusual nature, the cunning way it operates on several levels. It's a witty, knowing homage to classic detective fiction, but also a deeply sensitive examination of the loneliness and confusion of grief, and a reminder that every sudden death is a mystery that can't be fully explained. Abigail's own investigation into her brother's death mostly involves scouring her memory and those of Benjamin's friends for clues to his state of mind. "I've missed something that I'm hoping you can help me fill in some gaps," she says to one friend. It's a sad and frustrating endeavor. Bell takes the conventional approach, asking loopy questions designed to demonstrate his superior acuity. "Did it rain any time during the night?" he barks at one of the guests. "Does this house have gas central heating?" But he has an unusual degree of self-awareness for a fictional character. "My mind has been a little scrambled with all the confusion and misdirection and smoke screens and red herrings," he says. He understands that the job of his dim-witted, Watson-esque sidekick, Sacker, is to come up with a series of ideas for which I will invariably mock him. Hegarty tips her hand and her hat by including in the narrative three real-life lists of rules for fictional mysteries from the 1920s, the start of the so-called golden age of detective fiction. The idea was that a spirit of fair play should govern these wildly popular works, meaning that a clever reader should theoretically be able to solve the mystery via clues in the narrative. Among the directives, no occult phenomena or preposterous discoveries made by lonely scientists, by T.S. Eliot, 1927. Not more than one secret room or passage, by Ronald Knox, 1929. No willful tricks or deceptions, S.S. Van Dyne, 1928. It is worth noting here that Fair Play merely flouts many of these rules. Readers will enjoy the Easter eggs hidden in the underbrush, the fox terriers named Tommy and Tuppence, the elderly couple named the Westmacotts, the references to mostly forgotten titles from the early 20th century. And with his habit of herding the suspects into the drawing room to show off how obscure details play into his thinking, you will recall that she has been a champion gymnast in her youth, he notes of one suspect, describing her possible aptitude for escaping via the balcony. Bell is a metafictional hoot. I wished it were clearer how the small details of the dual investigations were meant to mesh. But they're wonderful separately, and as a whole, they serve as a bracing meditation on the different ways we perceive death and fiction. Abigail begins to realize that nobody can provide the answers she yearns for. Maybe that's an answer in itself. In focusing on how and why her brother died rather than on the fullness of his life, she's asking the wrong questions. He had a nice life, a friend tells her. A lot of hard times, of course. But I have a lifetime of good memories because of him. You do too. That's what I focus on. The reviewer, Sarah Lyle, writes for The Times, writing new stories, features, and analysis for culture, books, and sometimes national, international, and business. The Fate of the Day, The War for America, Fort Ticonderoga to Charleston, 1777 to 1780, by Rick Atkinson. The book cover depicts an 18th century battle with wounded and dead soldiers strewn about. In the background, through the smoke and haze, stands a large three-story country house. The reviewer is Amy Greenberg. Rick Atkinson makes the American Revolution come brilliantly alive. The second installment of the Pulitzer Prize winner's trilogy about the war animates an entire world, from battlefields and commanders to sounds and smells. There is a black-and-white drawing of the Battle of Saratoga. The caption reads, "General Benedict Arnold, fighting for the Continental Army, was wounded in the Battle of Saratoga in 1777. Does anyone doubt that the upcoming 250th anniversary of the American Revolution will produce a great deal of jingoistic nonsense parading as history? The bicentennial of our nation's birth took place during a singularly self-reflective historical moment, just a year after the complete withdrawal of the United States from Vietnam, and 2 years after Richard Nixon's post-Watergate resignation. But that didn't stop the Ford administration from feting George Washington as a saint, militiamen as disciplined sharpshooters who mowed down faceless redcoats, and the 13 colonies as having defeated the most powerful empire on earth in the name of all men being created equal. These myths, familiar to anyone who has heard the Hamilton cast album, were deliberately cultivated in the decades after the Revolution to foster American nationalism in a fractured body politic. Their promoters in 1976 hoped they would have the same effect. There's reasons to think that next year's celebration will up the ante. Days before the Department of Government Efficiency began dismantling the National Endowment for the Humanities, officials at the agency canceled the summer stipend program for researchers as part of programming adjustments made in preparation for the celebration of the nation's semi-quincentennial. Yet readers who believe not only that historical accuracy and patriotism are compatible, but also that acknowledging the complexity of the Revolution increases rather than diminishes the American victory, need not dismay, for we have Rick Atkinson. Casual browsers of the neighborhood bookstore could be forgiven for mistaking the first volume of Atkinson's Revolution trilogy as effluvia of the America First nostalgia machine. The blazing guns and vaguely antiquated font in the cover of Volume 1, The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777, provide little hint of the vast, brilliantly illuminated world contained within its nearly 800 pages. There is no better writer of narrative history than the Pulitzer Prize-winning Atkinson, who is able to transport readers to a different time and place without minimizing the differences of the past from the present. Deeply researched and meticulously structured, The British Are Coming is a sweeping account of the first 21 months of the war as seen from a remarkable number of perspectives. British and American, patriot and loyalist, Hessian and French. Atkinson considers the meaning of the conflict to the enslaved as well as the free, to officers, diplomats, soldiers, sailors, farmers, and tradeswomen. Dozens of vibrant character sketches reveal the poverty of our cliched understandings of the war's heroes and villains. At the end of Volume 1, Washington's political skills are evident, but his battlefield decisions are mixed. He misrepresents the magnitude of Patriot losses to the Continental Congress and passes blame around for defeats. His most successful commander, the dashing, fearless, and thin-skinned General Benedict Arnold, is repeatedly slighted. And in Atkinson's telling, King George, far from being a mere monster or fool, is a conscientious monarch who firmly believes that the majority of colonists are loyal and wish him to put down an unwanted uprising. Now in Volume 2, The Fate of the Day, The War for America, Fort Ticonderoga to Charleston, 1777 to 1780, we get an equally accomplished chronicle of the middle years of this multi-front war, so compulsively readable that despite its length, again around 800 pages, it's difficult to put down. We witness Washington mature as a commander. We come to understand why Arnold sells his allegiance. And we recognize King George's quandary as his generals repeatedly fail to draw this ruinously expensive conflict to an end. Just as enjoyable are Atkinson's portraits of lesser-known figures, such as the luminous and self-possessed Baroness Frederica Riedesel, the wife of a commander of Hessian forces, who travels to America with three daughters under the age of five. She rises to the challenges of war, cheering British troops, butchering pigs, and dodging rattlesnakes, and befriending Thomas Jefferson, who sells her a piano so she can sing arias while confined to a cabin in Virginia by the Continental Army. Atkinson, who has a fine sense of humor and irony, notes that 2 months after being released on parole by Congress, this Prussian-born supporter of the Tories gave birth to a fourth daughter whom she named America. To label this book military history or even American history does it a disservice. While battles are described with enough detail to please fans of the genre and enough skills to make both strategy and tactics legible for those who are not, Atkinson's canvas is vast. Once the French enter the war in 1778, the American Revolution becomes a world conflict involving Europe, India, and the Caribbean. Atkinson covers the fallout from the Battle for St. Lucia, where 1,500 French soldiers lost their lives, with as much care as the British capture of Savannah. Just as impressive is his attention to minutiae, the danger of using green timber in shipbuilding, the obstacles of finding housing in a city that's burned to the ground, divisions within individual families over politics, and the intense suffering caused by hunger, exposure, and disease on troops, displaced citizens, and horses. His command of the equine world is prodigious. Recognizing that the people of the 18th century had an intimate relationship with nature, Atkinson grounds his account in the weather, flora, fauna, tides, crops, and night skies that provided meaning in their lives. Woolly bear caterpillars displaying wide black rings are harbingers of a harsh winter in New Jersey. Stars above the Thames River wheeled in their courses, while fields of maize, rye, and flax lie abandoned mid-harvest near the Green Mountains of Vermont. Descriptions of events include sounds and smells as well as appearances. Where the Chesapeake Bay was wide, Atkinson writes, the land could be smelled in loamy whiffs but not seen. Swans and sea eagles circled the British fleet, and blue crabs swarmed by the many thousands near the surface. The fate of the day evokes dozens of battles, almost none of which marked a conclusive shift in the fortunes of Britain or the Patriots, but Atkinson's ability to work at this level of detail keeps his depictions fresh. This is great history. The reviewer, Amy S. Greenberg, is the George Winfrey Professor and head of the History Department at Penn State University. She is the author, most recently, of Lady First, The World of First Lady Sarah Polk. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.